comments as it relates to today's activities. The governor had a press conference and clearly outlined some principles as it relates to PERS reform. And we've had several bills on our calendar for today. And I'm going to clear our calendar. The governor has requested essentially what is House Bill 2004 and House Bill 2005. We'll work a little bit on House Bill 2005 today. He asked that both those bills be sent to him as soon as possible. We'll do everything we can to accommodate that, so we'll work on those first after we work on House Bill 2001, which will be the first bill out of this committee. And are there any questions on procedure or what the schedule might look like based on what I've indicated? Seeing none, I'll assume that we all understand what the work schedule will be, and the agendas can be published for next week that would include House Bill 2004 and 2005 only, and we'll work on those until we pass them or reach significant impasse and need to move on to something else. But I think it's incumbent upon us to try to cooperate as much as possible based on what the governor has indicated today, where he would like to head. And this issue is only going to be resolved if we work together in a bipartisan manner. So we'll look forward to doing that. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2001. And I'd like to call up, Dave is here. Dave, if you and Jim could come up, start with you guys. We have a, I believe it's the -2 amendment. And it should be carried as in the package here. Yes, it is.
Yes. And, Mr. Chair, you also have a fiscal statement on the -2s.
And we have a new fiscal on the -2s as well. So, Dave, why don't you start us off and indicate what changes we've made and how that differs from current law.
Chair Knoll, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. You remember at the last meeting when you were looking at 2001, you had before you a set of -1 amendments that basically set out criteria for when the board would ever again be able to credit Tier 1 member accounts with more than 8%. And the -1 amendments had three separate criteria that had to be met. One was that the current deficit that has been created by the need to credit more than the 8% in times when we haven't had 8%. In fact, we've had losses, that has to be gone. The second thing was that you had to reestablish the reserve, and there was language that appeared in the amendment that told you basically what the goal was for reestablishing on that reserve, and that was the zero balance when the last Tier 1 member went out the door. And then the third piece of that was a proposal that would have said you also had to have the system fully funded, the system. In other words, the system had to show that the actuary had determined that it was at a fully funded level. The -2 amendments that you have before you today will have basically the first two pieces exactly the same. The first two pieces are the same. The only difference that you see in paragraph B, which is the requirement of fully funding the reserve, is that there's been language on lines 11 and 12 that indicate that the board, after consultation with the actuary employed by the board, will have to make this determination as to what's necessary to ensure zero balance. I think the board does that anyway. They're not inclined probably to go out and make a determination without consulting the actuary on that anyway. I don't look at that as being a tremendously significant change. But paragraph C, appearing on lines 15 to 17, is the change. No longer are we talking about whether or not the system is fully funded. Instead, we're looking at saying not only do you have to have those reserves fully funded at the time the board might decide to distribute more than 8% to Tier 1 members, they have to look back 3 years and say we've had 3 years in which it's been fully funded prior to this date. So we're talking in the fourth calendar year, we have a situation where the actuaries come in and said, yes, the reserve account is fully funded, And not only that, it's been fully funded in the past three calendar years. And under those circumstances, there is the option of paying out more than 8% on Tier 1 accounts. And I think I'll let Jim talk about the where and why for on the thinking on that.
For the record, Chair Canope, members of the committee, I'm Jim Voitko, the Executive Director of PERS, and I really don't have too much to add to David's recounting of how the bill with the dash amendments would work. I would simply say that in advising the board, I would not indicate to the board in the future that they had an opportunity to credit above 8% unless we had confirmed that their goal for reserving to meet the Tier 1 guarantee had been fully funded for three consecutive years, and then in the fourth year we would interpret legislative intent in the law as telling us that the opportunity had once again emerged. Again, that's still subject to the first two tests that David said. The second one is the most relevant, that it's possible that even if there's been three consecutive years of full funding, that the SB 134 test might still be binding. But the whole point is to make a set of criteria here that have to be met that are related to the health of the system, and only once those are met is the possibility of crediting above the assumed rate possible. Yes. If that's the intent of the draft, then I think we understand how to advise the board to execute it.
Jim, you have been clear that is the legislative intent that I had set out, and the goal was to strengthen these sections, and so I think you've said it very aptly.
I could add a few other comments about the question of the financial consequences of this. I know that the board, or I should say the committee, inquired of our actuary what the consequences would be of this bill and the constraining of the possibilities for above 8%, above assumed rate crediting. And he gave you a set of savings assumptions. He and David and I have had some communications here in the past day or two to confirm his understanding of what the draft said, which is exactly as David represented to the committee. And we've contacted him, and his view is that the ability for him to remove the expectation of growth above 8% is intact, and therefore the savings estimates that he gave to this committee still stand.
Thank you for that clarification, because that's clearly important for this bill to move forward, and I think we're all trying to achieve that goal, and it's good to know that he will be able to do that based on the passage and this bill being signed into law. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bokos, the 8% is an actuarial figure based on a 40-year estimate of what the average will be, right? Is that correct?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, that's correct. The average return for the fund assets over that period, given a certain investment strategy adopted by the OIC.
Follow up? I have a question as to what should we be considering as far as if it's an average, and yet we're really saying it's a fixed benefit. The fact that there's going to be a lot of years where it would be less than 8%. Is that something that is going to be a factor that we're not fully considering, or does this provide for that as well?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, the whole idea of in the draft bill, which reflects an existing provision in the legislation, but obviously strengthens it substantially, is that during the good times, the board is instructed to set aside those earnings for those times which you have just mentioned, those inevitable times when investment returns fall below the long-term expectation. No one knows how many times that will happen, and no one knows whether or not those downtimes will exceed the uptimes, or vice versa. The challenge to the staff and the board is to try to set aside sufficient reserves so that even if we're surprised one way or the other, the reserves will prove sufficient, because SB 134 says do not leave a deficit behind for the rest of the system once Tier 1 has been completed 30 or 40 years out. Is that responsive to your question, sir?
It is.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you. Dallas, did you want to come up? I just had a couple of things that I wanted to put on the record on the fiscal, just so everybody is clear. I asked you earlier about the state agency all funds, and you've got in parentheses $21 million estimate, GF and LF, general fund, lottery fund savings. Could you explain the differential between the $21 million and the $53 million so everybody understands that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Dallas Wyman, the Legislative Fiscal Office. Yeah, these numbers are based on the ratio in the governor's budget of personal services costs between general funded and lottery funded agencies and other and federal funded agencies. We have some agencies that are strictly non-general fund, sizable agencies. Department of Transportation is a good one. Human Services has a lot of federal fund positions and the like. So based on the allocation in the governor's presented budget of personal service costs, which is salaries, overtime, and the like, the savings per Mark Johnson's calculations come out to about, they would be apportioned between general fund and other fund and federal fund by a general fund would be about $21 million. The balance of $32 million or so per biennium would be in the those other funded agencies.
And, of course, the state is responsible for a significant portion of K through 12 funding, which would probably be on this sheet listed as school districts at the tune of about $80 million in savings for local school districts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We kind of expect them to come to the state looking for funding for most, if not all, of that amount.
So of the $201 million in employer savings, likely the state's responsibility would be the $21 million and roughly that $80 million that would go to school districts.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Plus a portion of the community colleges that we provide support for, so it would be in excess of $100 million in a biennium general and lottery fund.
For the state?
For the state, yes.
Questions? Thank you. Jim, I had a further question for you as it relates to the fiscal. And then I know there are some people that may wish to testify who didn't make it earlier, and I'd like to get the nod from a couple of folks that we're okay on this language and that everybody's agreeable. But, Jim, as it relates to the school districts, can you tell me how much of a problem it would be for you to tell us individually by school district how much of that $80 million in savings or how that would be allocated across the school districts? Is that a nightmare or just a bad dream?
Chair Canope, members of the committee, that's probably a nightmare. The schools, as you know, are pooled. And so our knowledge of what goes on at the local school board level and how they absorb their costs and that sort of thing is limited. And I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's probably not something that we could produce in the time frame that we understand you're trying to address this bill. It's that complicated. Let me just look to see if my staff disagrees with the answer. Doesn't look like it. They're having a nightmare as well.
At least 2 weeks is what I'm hearing.
I think so.
Tell me what kind of staff time we're talking about. I want to be sensitive, obviously, to your staff time, but at the same time, I think there are probably a lot of members of the legislature who would be interested in knowing just directly for their school districts what kind of savings there would be on their PERS costs in the 03-05 biennium.
We could take a stab at it, but I will tell you that the state of our database and IT system, and I know you probably don't want to entertain the great deal that I have to say on that subject, doesn't give me comfort to even committing to 2 weeks, but the best I could do is come back in 24 hours and give you an estimate of how big, whether that's Halloween 13 or whether it's just a modestly scary movie.
Well, I appreciate that. As you know, I'm a supporter of updating that IT system because I think it's critical to your administrative function here in the future since we're asking you to make significant changes. I'd be happy to entertain that discussion certainly at another time in regards to your issues there.
I do have two other, Chair Canope, if I might interject, sure. So they understand that there are two things that are complicating this a great deal. One is the ultimate savings that would be projected or recorded at a school district X would be the rate that they would pay. And that requires us to run the entire actuarial model with these savings in it. And if the legislature acts on a number of things, and we've had this discussion before, that the actuary feels are fundamental changes in the plan, we would contemplate actually rerunning the rates completely for the coming biennium, for sure. But whether we do that once each bill passes, that's a great deal of work, as opposed to when we have a set of things that the legislature has done and we address them as a package. The other complication is, remember, schools no longer all pay the same rate, right? Because some of them have bought down their funded unfunded liability through bonding, and so now it's not so simple as it used to be. Each school has some rate differentials from many others. So I'm not whining. I'm saying that there are new complications in the plan that weren't present if you had asked me that question, say, 2 years ago.
And I'm not suggesting that the legislature wouldn't be high maintenance as it relates to wanting to know information after each bill passes, because it's kind of the way we are. Is, you know, we like to be able to give people the best information in the quickest time possible, but I do understand the constraints of those requests. But we probably will make them anyway, so I want you to understand that.
And I will expect
as we go forward. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Jim, the other day when actuary Mark Johnson was testifying, he mentioned, as we were discussing what would happen if the rate went from 8 down, that it could raise the employer's portion by as much as $3 billion to $20 billion. I didn't stop to think about what he was really saying at the time. Is it your understanding that the present unfunded deficit is about $17 billion?
No, my current understanding is as of 12/31/2002, just less than a month behind us, it was approximately $14.8 billion, and that's based on a conversation and emails exchanged with our actuary. But recall that it literally changes every day. Stock market hasn't been so good in January, and so it might have widened some, and we've also accrued additional pension benefits.
Okay, so, but the difference between 14.8 and 17 is a lot. So do you have any idea of what it might be presently?
I actually, Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, I did watch and listen carefully to Mark's testimony, and it's a familiar topic because he and I have had many discussions about this. It is true, and he and I are in absolute agreement that if the assumed rate is lowered to 7.5%, in essence what it means is that from this point forward, we expect 0.5% less return on the assets. Now suddenly that funding stream is gone and has to be replaced by some other funding stream. Under our plan, there is only one other funding stream we can change, and that's employer rates, so employer rates would go up. Your committee will probably, at the pleasure of the chair and your colleagues, look into a concept called partitioning, in which we try to avoid that consequence by keeping the assumed rate and the investments that justify it at one level for most parts of the fund, but not necessarily for some of the liability generating parts of the fund, in which we would invest differently, which would produce a lower expected rate of return, avoiding the big spike up in employer rates. I hope that was responsive, sir.
It is. Mr. Chair, possibly Steve might know.
Yeah, I think Steve, who is kind of hovering right behind you, why don't you come up to the podium?
Come on.
I had a discussion earlier with Steve as it relates to this issue because I was a little bit concerned when that was brought to my attention as well. And so, Steve, do you want to enlighten us a little bit?
And for the record, Steve Delaney, PERS Legislative Liaison. Yes, Jim's right. This was in Mark's discussion partitioning where he was referring, as my recollection that in discussion, was the $17 billion was referring to the amount of dollars currently being used to pay contributions to retirees in the benefits in force account. And so it was such a close number to the right actual liability number that people were used to, I think there was some confusion there.
A good staff jogs the director's mind. That $17 billion that the actuary referred to is actually the portion of the existing $30 to $34 billion that we have that's dedicated to serving current retirees' payments. Okay, and that's the 17. That wasn't a measure of UAL. That was the part that set aside to to continue to pay benefits. And the reason it was relevant to the actuary's response to the question is that the payments to existing retirees are a fixed and inflexible obligation of the system. Once they're in, they're in. And therefore, any diminution of the expected return on that $17 billion, i.e. a lower assumed rate, has to be made up by higher employer contributions. So that's where the $17 billion was. I apologize if we collectively have misled you.
I think it's important to clarify that. Any other questions? Thanks, Jim. Brian, did you want to give us your impression? I know you took a look at these amendments, and they were wordsmithed pretty significantly.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, I represent a number of organizations, but also the PERS Coalition. I'm the point person on this particular bill, and if you recall, I'm the one that testified on their behalf. After consultation with not only the chair and staff and Dave Hendricks and our attorney and all the other attorneys that could be found and rounded up, we think that the Dash 2 amendments are a good improvement over the Dash 1, and we're in support of the bill. The other thing that I would mention is but if you look at the fiscal on this, and I know that those of you who have read it understand the significant movement that the employees of this state have just made. This is a nearly $1 billion change in the PERS system, first bill out of the chute. And for the employees to make that kind of a movement and offer to help stabilize the PERS system, I think, is a very significant message to this body and to the citizens of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Brian, as this bill moves forward, you don't anticipate the need to change the language on the Senate side. I guess I'm looking for some reassurance that I won't be an unwitting partner in what we know as legislative ping pong from chamber to chamber. So, just from your, I know that you said that you're supportive of the bill. I just want to be clear that it's your belief that this language does, in fact, get us where we need to be, and that there aren't any further changes that need to be made to this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm comfortable with this bill in its current form. The other PERS Coalition members have reviewed, and again, under consultation from our attorney, Mr. Hartman, he's satisfied with the language that it accomplishes your goals. And is a part of a package that we're looking at to support. So I don't anticipate any changes in the Senate whatsoever.
Thank you. Well, I know the $200 million in employer cost savings are significant movement, and we look forward to continued negotiations on other bills with everyone sitting at the table and working this out, because I think that's the only way we're going to reach an agreement on this issue, and I want to thank you for your participation so far in this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anybody else that wanted to give brief testimony before we move forward? Come on up. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Canope and members, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing 12,000 members of NFIB Oregon. I'm under clear direction from my board and membership to support House Bill 2001 and subsequent PERS reform bills. We're relatively new to the issue, which highlights the gravity of it for the employers that I represent. They are very clear and adamant in their sentiment that PERS is the most important issue of 2003. They're equally clear that there's no issue that is more important to the credibility of state government than PERS reform. So we endorse House Bill 2001. The cost savings are a substantial and hopeful beginning to our membership, and we're grateful.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt, Associated Oregon Industries. PERS reform is a major goal for our membership this legislative session, and we certainly support House Bill 2001 as not only the first step, but as a giant step in PERS reform, in major PERS reform. Oregon business supports your efforts and salutes your cooperative efforts with the governor. We think together, and it's nice to have the legislature and the governor working together, that we think this will make a huge difference in the days ahead for bringing PERS under control. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to personally thank you for your leadership in getting to this point, and obviously it's not over, but your tenacity in trying to get this thing moving and keeping it rolling, and now the new governor stepped in, will certainly help making it a lot easier to move forward. Finally, I'd also like to say that we also support the governor's stand on the mortality tables as well as change in the board membership, and we wanted everybody to know that we, again, as my partner here has said, we support your efforts and look forward to more reform in the days ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Russ Walker for the record. I'm the Northwest Director of Citizens for Sound Economy. We have approximately 10,000 members in the state of Oregon. And I just wanted to take a moment and say how pleased we are with the effort to reform PERS, and we think that the board, the committee, has shown a commitment toward that with this bill, and that the savings are substantial, and we think it's a good start in the right direction, and we're also pleased with the comments out of the governor today, as well as the efforts by the committee on other reform, and we look forward to seeing that reform become law.
Thank you. Questions? Nope. Thank you. Anyone else want to testify before we move forward in our work session? Seeing no one else who wishes to testify, do I have a motion for the Dash 2 amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I move the Dash 2 amendments be adopted for House Bill 2001.
Representative Brown has moved that we move the Dash 2 amendments. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the Dash 2 amendments are in the bill. Do I hear a motion for the bill?
Mr. Chair, there is a typographical error on the amendment that you may want to change. As I read through it, I noticed that there's a word, I think it's consolation needs consultation. So you just want to may want to get that corrected before you. It's in line 9.
Yes. That's the draft.
Oh. You might have the draft.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Dash 2.
I don't know. I don't know.
The line 11 on the...
I saw the draft.
Yeah, it wasn't a draft, and I'm sure that...
It's fine.
It was correct. It appears to be correct in the new version.
Thank you for the new
version. Yeah, nearly gave Dave a heart attack there. the reason that occurred is because I did allow the draft out before the actual... all the proofing had been done, but I wanted to make sure that everybody understood the direction we were headed and was okay with that before we went to final form. But that was a good catch.
As much as I'm reading the bill.
Let it not be said that Representative Richardson is not working hard here in the legislature and reading his bill, so the people at home will know that Representative Richardson is working hard. That's good.
Mr. Chair, I would move that HB 2001 be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson has moved that the House Bill 2001, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
I'd just like to also second the comments that were made by some of the people here there, and commend you for the work that has been done on this piece of legislation and the other people involved. It's obviously it's a small step, first step in PERS reform, but one giant step for the state of Oregon, I'm sure.
Thank you. Other comments? Anybody else? I'd just like to say that I do appreciate the cooperation that we've started out with. I hope that continues. All these issues are not going to be as easy. There are no easy PERS bills. As we found on this one, we would have liked to have moved it on Tuesday, but as we know, words do mean things, and it's important to make sure that they're right rather than first. And in this process, we've had good communication from everyone involved. I hope that if somebody feels like they're being left out, they will let us know that. But to the degree possible, we want to make sure that everybody is in on all the discussions, because I think that'll make this process go much smoother. And it's our intent to be as open as we possibly can be and still move this process forward in a timely manner as the governor has requested. Anyone else? With that, will the clerk call the roll? And you say aye or nay on the vote.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representing Kapori.
Aye.
Representing McPherson.
Aye.
Representing Nolan.
Aye.
Representing Richardson.
Aye.
Representing Scott.
Aye.
You put this back in the same time.
Chair votes aye, and we'll carry the bill. This will not be a consent calendar bill. I think it's likely that we need to discuss this further. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2001 is declared passed and moved to the House floor. Congratulations, committee. I will close the work session on House Bill 2001 and will open a public hearing on House Bill 2004, and would like to call Jim Boyko. Did you have some presentation to make? It looks like we have it on the overhead here. House Bill 2004 is otherwise known as the mortality table bill.
Chair Canope, members of the committee, once again, I'm Jim Boyko, the executive director of the Public Employees Retirement System. We have prepared a book for you. Once again, I have to say that there are very few PERS issues that aren't complicated. It's an unfortunate thing. And I wanted to take a few slides that many of you have seen before and go over them in a little more detail, because I think they give you a sense of what's going on with respect to the mortality table issue. Before I do that, let me explain what is in your book. First of all, there's the few slides that we're going to walk through today. Then there are, behind those slides is a letter that I drafted to respond to a set of questions about mortality tables that was given to me by Senator Nelson from the other body. And the reason I included that letter, even though some of the status of the issue comments are dated, is that there's a discussion in that letter about the role that mortality tables play in the system, why they are important, how they're used in the private sector or in the financial community to annuitize sums of money, and also how the issue connects to what the system's notion would be of the benefit earned or the accrued benefit. And that's something that we're going to talk about in a moment. Now we're going to take some of the slides that we did before. Then what you have in the remainder of the book are five items that are documents that were developed by us during the PERS board's deliberations on this topic, and they are presented in chronological order from the most recent to the most to the oldest, when we first began working with the PERS board on this issue back in 2001. The early ones, items, for example, 5 and 6, particularly 6, talk about the mortality table issue in very broad terms, because at that point the board had not narrowed its policy options and was looking at the broad landscape of mortality table questions. As we moved on to items 4 and 5 and 6 in particular, the board narrowed its options so the documents that you see there no longer talk about, for example, immediate implementation, because the board had put that aside and instead had chosen other policy courses, and so the documents reflect our analysis of the more constrained set of options that the board had directed us to look at. With that, I'm going to just go through a few slides, and then I'll field questions on the topic. Mortality tables are particularly important, more important for the PERS system by far than the average pension system. And the reason for that is our hybrid nature. What the PERS system does under Money Match is bring together over an employee's career a pool of money that are based on contributions from the employer, from the employee, and earnings on the building corpus. And then at the time of retirement says, what benefit will that sum of money support? And of course, to figure that out, you need to know two things. One is you need to know how long the benefit's going to have to be paid. Somebody who retires at age 80, you can assume that they're not going to live as long as what the mortality tables say. Somebody who retires at age 56 or 58 or 60 has a much longer longevity. So you have to figure out how long that corpus of money that's been built up is going to have to be used and generate payments. And the other is what that corpus is going to earn during retirement. That's the assumed rate. We're only going to focus on the one factor, and that is the mortality table issue. So we need to know, as the first bullet point says, how long a retiree is going to live when we take that corpus of money that's been built up under Money Match and turn it into, transform it into a monthly benefit. But that monthly benefit is supposed to be equivalent, actuarially equivalent to the corpus. PERS uses the factors that are called actuarial equivalency factors that are driven by two things. Our estimate of how long we have to make the payment, that is how long the retiree will live, and the earnings that we'll get on the corpus while we're paying out the money to the person. We, however, when we estimate how long a person is going to live, we assume that they're going to live as long as they would have been estimated back in the late 1970s. And, of course, it's great news for humankind. We're living longer. In fact, we're living a lot longer. So that when we take that corpus and we say, for example, and I'm picking numbers just an example, and we think a person that has an account of $100,000 corpus and they're going to live 10 more years, our best estimate, we could pay out roughly, forgetting the earnings on the money, $10,000 a year for 10 years. That's fine, except in the current circumstances, and I think everybody agrees that this is the fact case, people are actually living 14 years. So that if we set an annual payment of $10,000, the corpus actually loses its ability to finance the benefit at the end of 10 years, and we have 4 years actual payments left to do. That's why the third point there is that when we underestimate how long people will live, we set the monthly payment hot too high, and the corpus, from a financial point of view, is exhausted before the retiree actually dies, on average. And what that does is that raises system costs. So I know that's my best shot at trying to give you a sense of what happens at the point of retirement to a money match balance and the role that our estimates of how long we have to pay it come into play. Just to give you a little sense of history again, the board, this was flagged as an issue for us in the year 2000 when we brought in Mercer and Company to do an audit of our actuary's assumptions. And basically their conclusion is our actuary does good work, staff does good work, but there were a few things they took issue with, and one of them was the use of the old mortality tables in this transformation of a corpus of money into a stream of monthly payments. The board systematically, to its credit, took every one of the actuarial audit findings and methodically worked through a response to them. In this one, it turned out obviously to be quite thorny, and the process took quite some time. So the board, through 2001 and 2002, held many committee meetings, board meetings. We issued draft rules. We held numerous meetings with our stakeholders, but there was another venue in which this topic was being addressed, and that's the second bullet point. In Judge Lipscomb's court, plaintiffs suing the system and the board had argued that the use of these inaccurate tables was not appropriate, and as you all know, the judge agreed, and his order has become final. In addition, there was a third venue in which action was going on the mortality table question, because as I've testified before this committee before, there is no clear and explicit direction in the statute about exactly what mortality policy we're supposed to use. There's standard financial practice, but it is not referenced into the statute. It exists in the real world, and we are driven by the statute, as I said in my letter to Senator Nelson. So we've had to infer from phrases like things should be actuarially equivalent as to what an appropriate mortality policy might be that the legislature had wanted to communicate to us. In the special sessions 3 and 5, the legislature considered bills that in fact would put into the statute for the first time in 56 years a clear indication of what mortality table policy you wanted us to use in transforming a corpus into a stream of monthly payments that were equivalent or bear whatever relationship the legislature wanted. The board, in the meantime, continued to eliminate options and work down to what it felt was the right way to introduce the transition and execute the transition to modern mortality tables. And in August of last year, voted to move from where we were to the new tables, that is, the most accurate tables that the actuary could present, and to do so in 1104, but directed us to create a methodology that that involved what in essence was holding portions of the corpus harmless to the effect of mortality changes, is the best way I could phrase it, and I'm about to go through what that means in a moment. First of all, this slide talks about the corpus, and I said a portion of the corpus. What the board's direction is, and this is different than the judge's, and we'll talk about what how immediate implementation compares to the board's process. What the board has directed us to do and is prepared on February 25th to put into final rule is to, in essence, bifurcate the corpus into two parts. At the dividing line, 1104, this account basically changes into two accounts. The solid line up above indicates the total account value. But what is being sheared away is the dotted line down below, and that is the portion of the corpus that is being built up by contributions after 1104. The red line indicates what you'd call the old corpus, which is the 1104 balance, but also growing by the accrual of additional earnings on into the future. This is important to note because, remember, a monthly allowance starts with what is the corpus and then has factors or transformational factors applied to it. And now we look at the second part of that. What monthly payment, what monthly benefit, monthly retirement allowance, as it's often termed, comes out of the various ways of looking at mortality table. The red line down below, is this the laser pointer?
Yes, like that.
Great. Let's see if I... No. Oh, there we go. The red line down below... well, let me start back here. This is the monthly allowance. This is a conceptual chart that, prior to any change, would be generated as the corpus grew over time and was transformed with the old tables into a monthly payment. Under the board's view, let's take immediate implementation because it's the simplest. At this point, if we changed the factors, the transformational factors, to make them reflect an accurate estimate of how long this retiree would live, it would dictate a set of monthly payments that was lower. Now, there, you know, from a member's point of view, this is, hey, I'm getting a lower benefit. From a financial analyst point of view, what you've done is adjust the payment, the monthly payment stream, to accommodate the length that it has to be paid and the corpus that you have to transform into a monthly retirement benefit. The board looked at immediate and, for a whole variety of policy reasons, felt that that was not what they wanted to do. So they went down a different track and asked us, is there a way to put in place something such that the benefit calculated at this point in time when the policy change takes place, that the resulting benefit using the new factors when somebody retired over time would never be lower than this amount? And we said yes, but you have to tell us what happens to this account. Is literally the account frozen? In which case, this would be a straight horizontal line. Or do new things get added to the account after the policy change? And the board deliberated on this topic and decided that they wanted not to have a flat account frozen, but they wanted to allow the account to grow by having the account earnings subsequent to the policy date added to the account. So we are now not transforming. We are in essence doing two transformations. We're taking the old account balance, and flip back to the last screen, Christina, thank you. This balance, which represents everything under the red dotted line, And we are transforming that with the old factors. And then this new part, we are adding to that and making a total benefit and then transforming it under the new factors. Then we compare the two results. And the member gets the highest of the two, according to the board's policy. So let's switch back to the benefits. So the way this works, I'm sorry.
Jim? Jim?
Yes.
At about this point in the presentation, I want to beat myself with my gavel. But how... You heard the governor's announcement today. I think he said he wanted to go back to 1103. How would that line, maybe it's unfair to ask you this early before you've analyzed that, but how would that line, how would those lines look based on what the governor said today?
Well, as best I understand it, to use this conceptual chart to understand what the governor said, and recall that I was just listening in the audience too, so I would like to look at the transcript carefully, but my understanding was is that all you would do is change this date to 1103, uh-huh. And that what I understood the governor to be proposing was immediate implementation from 1103 onward, which would be taking the corpus and using the accurate tables, which then would adjust the stream of benefits that equaled that corpus and would be this red line. So the date would change, this red line would change, and this line, which is the board's look-back calculation that allowed the benefit never to be lower than this green dotted line. This, in essence, this green dotted line is an expression, a financial expression of the old tables living on after the policy change until such time as enough new contributions have come in that when you take the total balance, use the new factors, it produces a higher benefit. So this is the expression of the old tables living on in financial terms. The governor, as I best understood it, would do this red line, and this date would be 1103.
I look forward to a financial analysis of how that happens. Now, obviously, there's people that have retired from 1103, I assume, to the present date. And what effect that would have on them, I don't know if it's fair to ask you that today, but I would be interested in that analysis.
I would be happy to do so. One of the things that we are doing, I'll alert the committee to this, we typically execute retirements on the dates that people have asked us to, but they're typically the end of the month. The first of the month. So we have some people that retired on the 1st of January. The next batch of checks that would go out, and the reason that checks are important is under law, that is when the retirement is completed. There's no backing out after we've issued a benefit. I am meeting with my staff on an emergency basis, given what the governor has said tomorrow, and we want to communicate with everybody that has a retirement pending at the end of this month, effective February 1st, to let them know about what's going on with respect to the deliberations of both the executive branch and the legislature, to see if they, just to make sure they understand what's going on, so that if the only reason that they filed a retirement application with us was to try to have their transformation occur completely under the old tables, that if that might not be a possibility, then we feel we owe it to our members to let them know, because maybe they might conclude that if that's the case, well, then I don't really want to retire. I'd rather work on in the public service. So we will have a crash effort that will be launched, that's being launched as we speak, to try to make sure our members understand the implications of both the committee's deliberation as well as the governor's speech, so that people are not making decisions on less information than we could provide them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Given what you said, Mr. Boyko, about the first benefit check creating a contract right, is there anything that would currently prevent you from issuing that check under the proposed scenario of an 0103 immediate and full implementation? And then if for any reason that were adjusted, going back and adjusting that for members so that you're not creating an inflated contract right?
I would make two comments.
Other than the administrative headache, and I respect that and understand it, but if it's a 35-year contract right, it may be worth a little bit of headache.
I appreciate that concern. Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, a couple things. I think that the payment date is an administrative line in the sand, and in some respects it is less a contract right, although there are rights involved potentially to the stream of payments. I think there's very little doubt that there's some. What specific ones I think are not so relevant to the question you asked, but what is relevant is that it's a commitment on the part of the member to go into retirement.
Right.
That is, once they get their check, they can't visit us next month and say, you know, I think I'd really not like to retire. There are ways of unretiring under the statute, but this is an important dividing line in terms of the commitment of the member, and that's why I'm sensitive to it. With respect to estimated payments, we've talked about this often because living under uncertainty as our system has, we often are uncertain about what the lawful payment might be or might be adjudged either by a court or by the legislature or down the road. And I can say that one thing we all agree on, and that is it is easier to send people makeup checks than a year or two later to send them a bill for benefits that they've gotten that are now adjudged inappropriate and we need them paid back. Probably the most heartbreaking part of my job is to send a bill to an 80-year-old retiree saying that for the last 7 years, we, for whatever reason, they've gotten $200 a month more than they should have, and they've got to pay it back. But I have no choice but to sign those letters by law. So we're trying to avoid that. Makeup checks are happy events.
Yeah. Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Do you know roughly how many people are in this window?
Yes, I have, I do know that we are scheduled to execute and set up for February 1st. The last I checked, about 1,463 retirements. It's a very large number. I think I testified, or maybe I mentioned it to the board, that it represents one third of the entire retiree workload that we normally are staffed for and would expect in a year.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Wicko, would you help us understand, when we refer to new mortality tables, how many options are there of mortality tables to choose from? And we're assuming that there is one mortality table that is the universal one that the world follows, but is that a correct assumption?
Representative Representative Richardson, there are many mortality tables, but not that many. And it depends on what population is being studied to generate it. Because a mortality table is nothing but a reflection of the experience of a population. What the process that happens is that our actuary looks at the latest mortality studies done by the Social Security Administration, by the Society of Actuaries. Those are done relatively infrequently, sometimes only once a decade. They're very comprehensive, very accurate, but they're not always available when you need to make the decision. The actuary, however, every 2 years by statute, must come to the board and recommend and conduct evaluation. We must conduct evaluation, and as part of that, he must recommend a mortality table assumption. And the board accepts it, doesn't accept it, changes it. And his mortality table assumption is leavened by the examination of the actual experience of longevity in the Oregon, in the state of Oregon, and in our population. So we actually study PERS, police and fire retirees. We study general service workers. We study teachers. So we have excellent data on what the longevity experience and trends are for the population that we're doing this financial transformation for, and those weigh very heavily in the actuary's recommendation to the board.
Follow-up? Do you know how significant the difference is between the mortality table that you're discussing and the one that's used by the insurance industry for life insurance?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, I've not done a comparison, but I would speculate that the differences are largely only in the different populations that might be studied. So, for example, we by definition have lots of police and firefighters in our population. Firefighters in particular have slightly shorter lives, although they're catching up in longevity with general service workers. An across-the-board insurance study might look at likely purchases of their life insurance policies. So there may be differences that are based on whose longevity you're estimating, but I think the process and the methods that are used by our actuary, I doubt would be in any way different than those would be followed by an insurance company.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Richardson.
I'd like to have a copy of the mortality table that's being proposed and the one that's currently being used, just so I can look at them.
I'm sure we can arrange that.
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, we'd be happy to provide it. There is a mortality table for every age, actually every month within every age. So there's one for a PERS retiree age 58, 1 month, 58, 2 months, and we'd be happy to generate those tables and give you copies.
What's the total? What are we looking at as far as volume?
We're looking at lots and lots of tables of numbers.
I mean, I've seen we use mortality tables frequently, and it's under 10 pages. Are we talking about 100 pages, 1,000 pages before I get requests?
One of your colleagues, Representative Smith, actually asked us for a copy, and in my recollection, it was about tables of numbers, longevity estimates for each age by month from probably age 48 through 80. It would be about that thick.
I just get on CD. Can you give it to me digitally? Because that would be easier than printing it out.
We can try.
How long ago was that presented to Representative Smith? I mean, within last year?
It was probably last fall.
Okay. If I can just borrow his, that'd be fine, but if you could just give me a copy, and if it's digitally prepared, that would be fine, too.
We'd be happy to comply.
Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Voitko, I believe I understand that the decision of the PERS board to go with the green line in that diagram rather than the red line was based at least in part on advice received from the Department of Justice about an issue of tax qualification. And I'm wondering if you're able to speak to that issue or whether we need to get somebody else who would have legal background to speak to it.
Chairman Canope and Representative McPherson, one is I would highly recommend that you consult other authorities, but as the client of much of this advice, of unfortunate necessity, I've absorbed a lot of it. My only problem in responding is that I can't discuss the advice itself because it's a confidence that's being held by the board, which is not mine to break. We've had this discussion before, but I can tell you the general concept that is discussed in the letter to Senator Nelson, and it's called the accrued benefit under ERISA. And this would be true for most pension plans, I think, whether they're under ERISA or not. It's generally a good practice and required under ERISA that you tell the member how they can figure what benefit they have accrued through any point in time. That is, what have they earned? It's part of their compensation, so at some point, we should be able to tell a member, at this point in time, you've accrued the following pension benefits. So the notion of accrued benefit is endemic to all pension plans. It's required to be specified for ERISA plans. Public plans are generally not subject to ERISA. And there's a whole set of reasons why the government didn't impose ERISA standards on the plans of states, counties, and so on. That does not mean that ERISA standards don't have meaning for pension plans, and that is a complex legal topic about which I suspect, Representative McPherson, you know more than I. But you're exactly right. The board's for reasons that were deliberative and thoughtful, not willy-nilly, the board decided that it wanted this benefit not to ever go down and instead rise with earnings in the corpus as of this date until such time as the total corpus, when these new post-1-1 or post-implementation date contributions were added, when transformed using the new factors, produce the highest benefit. And this line really represents a board's attempt, and it is titled so in the documents that we used in working with the board on this, the accrued benefit. What's unusual is that the board, because the accrued benefit is not defined, this is another area in the statute where there is no definition that I've seen that says, by the way, here is the accrued benefit, here's how you calculate it, and so there's differences of opinion. And in fact, you heard the governor make some specific mention about the account. There are two ways to say what the accrued benefit is under Money Match. One of them is to say it's the account balance. The account is the benefit. The corpus is the benefit, and therefore the accrued benefit is the account balance as of this date. However, there's other schools of thought that say, well, but maybe it's the account balance and things that might accrue to the account balance post this date. The board spent a long time deliberating on this and decided that they felt that this definition of accrued benefit was correct. I will say that the board was put in the uncomfortable position because it wanted to move to modern mortality tables, but it wanted to protect some definition of accrued benefit. The statute has no clear and unambiguous one, so they constructed one. It may be the one the legislature wants. It may not be. But that's up to you to decide. But the board clearly has directed us to go in this direction. And as I say, I agree with Representative McPherson that analysis of what they thought their legal obligations were certainly played a role, and maybe their own policy preferences did. I can't go into the heads of each of the board members to decide why they chose to send us in this direction, but they did, and we have faithfully followed. This is what the draft rule that we are preparing for the board for the final approval on February 25th would do. I hope that was responsive.
It was. Thank you.
All done? Thank you.
Is there a signature first?
Before I close the hearing on this, we just want to make sure that nobody was signed up for today. Obviously, this mortality table bill will be a little bit longer term issue than the bill we just worked on, and the PERS restructure and the PERS board restructure bill. But we just want to make sure that if anybody came to testify today that they were able to do so. It doesn't appear as though anybody wanted to testify, so we're going to close the public hearing, which I assume I opened earlier, on House Bill 2005, was it? Okay. House Bill 2004. And I want to open another public hearing on House Bill 2005, which is the PERS Board Restructure Bill. And you had two amendments?
Yes.
Is that right, Kira?
Yes.
In your packets. And did you want to briefly explain what both of those amendments did as I looked for mine? Do you have yours?
Yeah.
Here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to go by memory here. We have a -1 amendment that I believe modifies the membership requirement to 4 members with the pension benefit to 1 member that's allowed to be a public representative. There's some other technical changes that restore the requirement that they be U.S. citizens. And the chair asked for an age requirement of at least 21 years of age.
Yeah, colleagues, as I looked at the current statutes, I think there was a requirement that you had to be a 2-year member of the state of Oregon, but I didn't see any age requirement, and not that it's likely to come up, but under that, you could be a 2-year-old if you had pension fund experience and serve on the PERS board. And although I know this isn't going to come up and it's not a significant issue, I thought that probably we should put an age minimum in there similar to the age that you could serve in the legislature, just to be safe, as long as we're redoing the prospects of and the function structure of the board, that there be an age minimum in there. And so I did request, after considerable thought, as I say, not a big issue, but as long as we're redoing it, I thought there probably ought to be an age minimum.
Okay. And the rest of the dash ones are just kind of conforming amendments that Mr. Hendricks did making those changes. And the dash two amendments retains the original bill but adds two non-voting members, one representing public employees and one representing public employers. So they would be full board members but not actually have a vote on the board.
It's a new concept that I wanted to introduce to everybody. I think it's important that employers and employees be able to see everything that happens as it relates to the PERS board and their decisions, although I think there needs to be some independence of the PERS board. And so this is one possible way to go. I believe the governor recommended a third option. And as I understood it, and I didn't see the whole thing, but I think he suggested that three members be public and independent and not identified by position, but there'd be one employer and one employee, essentially position. Does that square with what you heard, Representative McPherson?
It is.
Okay. So likely that needs to be drafted as well. And we could pick from among these three, or if there are other committee members who would wish to weigh on, in on this on their own ideas, we're happy to entertain them. So I just wanted to make that available. And of course, if the employers or the unions also have recommendations as to how we're going to restructure the board, they're free to make those recommendations. However, this bill is going forward. I will make that clear. But I don't have any predisposed position currently, but I think we ought to work it out as we go through this process. So does anybody have any further comment in that regard?
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson.
In view of the proposed modification of the bill, that we would have, there would be a slot on the board that would be for labor, in effect, and one for management, I have suggested and discussed with some of the committee members the and with Legislative Council the concept of adding language that would clarify that those members owe the same duty in general, the same fiduciary duty as the members of the who are drawn from the general public, and if, and would with your approval would ask Legislative Council to include that in the draft changes.
I'm happy to accommodate you if we can accomplish that. By legal means, I'm happy to have that as part of a draft. And while I think we could all recognize that they would likely understand that that is their position, I don't think it would, as long as we can legally do it, I don't think it would hinder that to have it in statute as well, just for clarification purposes, because I think there's been a vagueness in statutes in the past, and I think that's gotten us into some trouble. At least as it relates to the PERS board, and I think we want to be clear from the outset of the process that we would like to see followed in the future and how we'd like those board members to respond to their duties. Any other comments as it relates to that? Is there any testimony that anybody would like to give today on House Bill 2005? I actually made it House Bill 2005 because it has five members. And it was easy for me to remember. So, not that I have memory problems. But there are going to be a significant amount of PERS bills that are working their way through the process, and I thought this was a way to identify that particular bill. If there isn't anything else, I don't think we're prepared to go to work session today on House Bill 2005, but it would be my interest to go to work session next week on House Bill 2005 to keep the process moving forward as the governor has requested. And I'd prefer that to be Tuesday as opposed to Thursday. So those who wish to have their input in this regard need to show up on Tuesday. So we will likely have a significant public hearing and work session on Tuesday on this issue. So make sure you're getting your amendments drafted. And to the degree that we can, let's try to make them complete amendments as opposed to choosing different dashes and trying to add them together, because that can complicate things as you go to work session. So let's try to work together and communicate in this process so we don't end up having a problem where we can't go to work session because we have conflicting amendments that we'd like to put into the bill, but for some reason Legislative Council needs to work them out, and that just delays the process. So get down there to Legislative Council and get your favorite draft on these amendments. As I said, the governor's preferred solution will be drafted as an amendment, and we'll be happy to entertain that one as well. Any other questions in regards to this bill? Nope. All right. Anyone else wishing to testify on the PERS Board Restructure Bill, House Bill 2005? If not, I'm going to close that public hearing on House Bill 2005. And because we are planning to clear the calendar for these two issues, I don't think it's appropriate at this time that we need to open hearings on the rest of the agenda items. And we will, in fact, have only two items, as I indicated, on our schedule until we have cleared those up or have found that we are just at a significant impasse and they need to be negotiated further. But it is my intent to move both those bills in a time frame that the governor would be interested in. So I look forward to everybody's cooperation. But here again, the bills will need to be right, not rushed. So please make sure that you're giving your input, because there won't be a lot of downtime in this process. This committee only meets 2 days a week. And while that will be plenty of time, these committee hearings may go longer next week. So prepare your schedules to go beyond 5 o'clock. And we'll start promptly at 3 and move forward on these bills. Any questions? Seeing no questions, we're going to adjourn for committee for today and look forward to seeing you again on Tuesday.